You're listening to Sweat, Snot and Tears, brought to you by Netmums. I'm Annie O'Leary.
And I'm Wendy Gollidge. And together we talk about all of this week's sweaty, snotty and tearful parenting moments.
With guests who are far more interesting than we are. Welcome to the latest episode of Sweat, Snot and Tears, you lovely lot. I am feeling teary because I am weary. I am overtired and emotional and I feel like the world's about to end. Wendy?
Well, I feel like the world's worst mother because I trapped my five-year-old daughter's thumb in the front door.
You are the world's worst mother.
I know. I spent all day in A&E. She's fine. It's not broken, but I still feel bad.
And is it a mess now?
Yep.
Oh, poor child. Tell me it's not the hand she writes with.
It is the hand she writes with.
Oh, Wendy.
Of course it is.
What are we going to do? I know what we're going to do. We're going to talk to today's lovely guest, Mr. Tom Kerridge, who might be the nicest man who ever graces our TV screen, and he's going to make us feel loads better. Welcome, Tom.
Hello. Don't worry. I have trapped my son's hand in a door before, so don't worry. You're not on your own there.
Have you? And what was the outcome? Was his hand broken?
No, he's such a unit, he broke the door.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, bless. So what we tend to do, Tom, is we start our podcast by asking, has there been any sweat, any snot or any tears in your house today?
Snot, yes, because my son's approaching five. So like he's always picking his nose, which is standard behaviour.
Lovely.
Standard behaviour, like bogies for breakfast, whatever. But tears today, no. Not yet. I mean, the day's yet early.
Anything can happen.
Yeah, we still got to get through bedtime. Normally Friday, Friday, yeah. So it was the end of a school week. He will be exhausted. However, he does like to stay up a little bit later on a Friday. So it's trying to find that fine line between bedtime and not, isn't it? So if you miss past that last little bit, then that final half an hour of getting him into bed, there probably will be tears later on, I would have thought.
It's like walking a tightrope, isn't it? That thing between being nice and letting them stay up a bit so they don't cry about that, but then also then not having an overtired child on your hands, which is possibly the worst thing in the world.
It is, but, you know, it's all part and parcel of it, isn't it? It makes it all good fun.
It does. So which end of the day do you prefer as a parent? Are you a morning dad or a bedtime dad or both?
I'm hardly ever there the bit in the middle. So some mornings I'm up and gone before he's up. So he's actually a very early riser. Most mornings it's normally with a six in. I mean, some mornings it's 5:30, 5:45.
Oh, I can't do anything with a five in it. I can't. Yeah,
it's around about 6:15 is the average wake up time, about 6:15. So some mornings I'm up and gone before he's up. And then obviously there's a lot of nights when I'm not back in time for bedtime, but I try at the minute. I've actually been able to take him to school three times this week, which is
well. I guess lockdown has helped a little. It's got to have been positive for something. Does it mean you've been around a bit more?
It does mean I've been around quite a bit more, which is great, particularly at the weekends, which has been obviously. I mean, I've still been working, but not quite in the same capacity. Yeah. Slightly differently, a lot more in the terms of press and publicity and media and talking about the current situation that we're all in. Yeah, but for that point of view, it does mean that I've been at home quite a bit more, which has been lovely.
Now, something I want to ask you is, your son's name is AC, which might be the coolest name on the planet. how did you come up with that? It's awesome.
Well, it was obviously when naming children is quite a big thing, isn't it? It suddenly becomes quite a huge responsibility that they're going to have it for the rest of their life.
I know. It's quite pressurised, isn't it, the picking of the name?
It is, yeah. And obviously before he was born, you have kind of that short list, don't you, of what it's going to be. And then we had a favourite of what it was. And then and then about a week before he was born, we suddenly swerved and went, no, we're not going to call him that. We need to find something else. And started looking through listed names and whatever else. And obviously it was our first son. So you just go, okay. So it's an old Anglo-Saxon name from number one for first, which is obviously it's where ace comes from. So AC. So we were like, I love that. I love the idea of it.
Yeah,
like, so
it's
that's
brilliant.
So that's where it comes from. Yeah, that's where it comes from.
I didn't know that.
There's a lady where, I'm not going to say where actually, because that will identify her, but one of the women I know from school has got three sons called Jet, Ace and Flash.
Nice.
So can you go for the hat trick, Tom? That's what we expect. Three sons.
No, I'll tell you what, just the one is hard enough as it is. I mean, fair play to everybody who's got loads of kids, but honestly, I absolutely love him more than absolutely everything on earth. But you know, those moments when it is very difficult, particularly when you have a busy lifestyle, I just try how people cope with loads of kids running around plus busy lives and jobs. I've no idea.
So you're not going to have a brood of 10 then?
No, that's definitely not the plan at the minute. That's probably couldn't be furthest away from what we're thinking about right now. A lot of it. We've got 250 staff, which are pretty much most of the time almost like children anyway. So making sure that they're okay is the biggest thing.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So I've been glued to your show about saving the nation's pubs.
Yeah.
Tell us about it. I mean, it's been such a tearjerker. I felt very emotional watching it. I mean, I know obviously the main priority with COVID is saving people's lives, but saving people's livelihoods really bloody matters, doesn't it?
Oh, it's huge, you know. And of course, I think at first, that first part of lockdown and that understanding of what's going on with this virus has been, you know, everyone's been terribly frightened. And of course, people's lives are the most important thing, and making sure that people are safe and well. But I think the longer it goes on, the more you recognise that it is something that we're having to live with at the minute, the same as, you know.
It's the new normal, isn't it? Like this, we've got to get our heads around living with it, haven't we?
Exactly. Until this vaccine comes out, and it's trying to find the balance between the two things. And right now it is beginning to stretch business and livelihoods and lives in other ways. You know, people are very nervous about their jobs. People are losing their jobs. People have lost. People are struggling with income. People are struggling with the mental health of being at home. People are struggling with not going to the doctors, not going to hospitals, missing out on routine scans and checks. And, you know, so the health of the nation is beginning to be affected in many, many other ways, as well as, you know, economically, where many people face poverty. You know, it is now beginning to have a huge adverse effect across the board on a national scale that isn't just about COVID-19. So I think trying to find that balance is something that we all need to try and understand without too much in the way of extreme points of view. That this is the problem with, I think, this day and age, and the way that the media and social media works. Everything is shouty and extreme without it being balanced. Mm-hmm. And it is those conversations and that understanding that everybody needs to get. But yeah, moving things forward and getting things open and getting things going, I think, is vitally important to the survival of many industries, not just hospitality.
How are you coping with the stress of having so many employees and businesses that can't open? It must be really taking its toll.
I'm exhausted by it, in all honesty. It's very, very tiring. But at the same point, it's also very, you put yourself in a position of responsibility when you become an employer. You know, you build teams of people around you, and, you know, and you continue building those teams. And when things are good and you're moving forward as leadership, you need to be able to lead. You need to be able to lead by example, and you need to be able to encourage, and you need people to be able to grow. And you also need to be able to make those very tough and difficult decisions. And we go through that every day. And it's kind of finding that balance, like everybody, the escapism that you get from having kids. From my point of view, having AC is quite he knows there's a virus going on, and he knows things are a bit weird, and he knows when daddy drops him off at school, I've got to be wearing a mask and all that sort of stuff. Mm. But it's not the realities of what's going on outside in real life. He's got absolutely no idea. So, you know, what he wants to do is play with dinosaurs and build a massive Lego castle. For his you know what I mean? It's kind of like, and that kind of escapism is amazing. You know, going to the park, riding his bike, feeding the ducks, all just mundane, normal stuff is a wonderful way of escaping the hard realities of what's going on. So as a coping mechanism, to be honest, I just, my whole life, most of the time, is slightly removed from the realms of normality. Nothing in my life is, I don't really have routine, and I don't really, I love routine, but that's gone years ago. You know, every day is very different, and every day is very different.
Is that just part of the deal of being a chef? Is it just carnage all day, every day?
And chefs actually love routine. You know, the idea of things working day in, day out the same. I think that the key to successful restaurants is always about consistency. And consistency is led by, you know, recipes being the same and repeated over and over again, repetitiveness, and that kind of routine is knowing the time that you start work, where the systems are, where the way that everything works on a daily basis is key to the way that chefs actually work. But I think the moment you put yourself as a business owner and you open numerous sites, or you have different pressures put on you from different angles and different conversations, and then all of a sudden you put yourself in a position where you're, I suppose, you get involved in media in different ways, but then you get pulled about in so many different times in the morning, different things to do. You know, for example, looking at new meat supplies and business. So Monday morning, for example, we're probably heading into Smithfield Market at 4 o'clock in the morning. Whereas, you know, I might be doing something late at night, and then we might be doing a podcast, or we might be doing a television appearance, or cooking live on this morning, or who knows? There's so many different. Or going into a restaurant and talking about the new dessert menu that we opened within London. They're all very, very different. So there is absolutely no routine, and in some ways I absolutely love it, because I like chaos in my life, but it's normally, I used to enjoy it under my own control. So I gave up drinking, and I used to like the chaos of drinking, but now I don't have that. I quite like the chaos of everything else, but sometimes it feels completely out of control, and I don't mind that. I don't mind the world of the unknown.
Why do you like chaos, Tom? That's fascinating.
I find it's new. You don't know what's going to happen next. It's like walking into a room of loads of people that you don't know. I don't mind. I like being in conversations in business or with people. I quite like awkward silences, because I like to think it's going to break next. Or I like all of that. Like is probably the wrong word. I enjoy.
You thrive on it. Do you thrive on the chaos?
Yeah, I do. I really kind of enjoy those. Well, this, you know, this might be interesting. You know, where are we going with this? Or I do like the upheaval of stuff. And you get stronger as a person when you deal with things like that on a constant basis. And you're only ever going to get stronger as a person dealing with things like that if you face up to it and go through it.
Yeah, that's a good attitude.
So I'm going to take you back to about the most chaotic thing that can happen in anybody's life, which is the arrival of a baby.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about AC's arrival into the world and how you, the thriver on chaos, found having a newborn at home, because that is the epitome of chaos as far as I can tell.
Yeah. I mean, everyone tells it. So as chefs, we do very well with no sleep. Like, it's no problem. We normally get for 4 or 5 hours. You know, if you're on a really busy push, you know, you could survive on 5 hours sleep, and your adrenaline gets pushed and you get up. But actually, it's very, very different having kids, isn't it? You end up doing 4 or 5 hours sleep, but that's throughout the day in broken little bits of half hour. So there's not even like a solid 2 or 3 hour gap where you sleep solidly. So that point was incredibly that he didn't sleep through the night properly for the first time for 18 months, not a single night.
I can beat you. 2 years, 4 months we had.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. And you're still alive to tell the tale.
Yeah, and
barely.
I had another one.
She's barely alive.
Unbelievably, I went again.
But it is very difficult, isn't it? It's that chaos of it is crazy. But I mean, him being born it's quite a crazy thing to experience. But it's also, I mean, it's amazing. It's an incredible thing. And he's, I mean, he was massive as well. He was huge. So he was like
a giant child.
He was 11 pounds 4.
So. Oh my goodness me!
Yeah, so he was born. He was almost born a teenager. He came. He was born being able to drive and argue back.
But tell us about that as a dad, because obviously you're speaking to two mums.
Yeah.
How does that moment when someone hands you your, I was going to say little baby, but in your case, 11 pound 4 monster baby.
Yeah.
You know, tell us how that feels to you as a dad, because it's impossible as a mum to know.
Yeah,
it's incredibly special, actually, because you're slightly disconnected from the whole experience. Like, for the 9 months prior, you're not growing it. You're just dealing with the trying to build the house and help the nesting process and go through understanding, trying to understand what your partner or wife or other half wants and needs that day, and trying to trying to create everything around that helps create that environment, but you're not experiencing anything. Nothing is happening to you physically different, or even, you know, hormonally, mentally different. You're just having to deal with the situation in a different way. So,
and a mentally hormonal wife, probably.
Yeah, actually, Beth was great. She was fantastic. She didn't really have much in the way of cravings or mood swings, or she was very tired. But it was in terms of a pregnancy, for Beth's point of view, it wasn't. The first 16 weeks were quite hard, but actually the rest of it it wasn't as traumatic as some of our friends had had. So it was like, okay, and you get to that point, and it was quite important for us. So we knew whether we were having a girl or a boy about halfway through. We made the decision, and I say we, Beth made the decision to go for the we should know.
As all good women should.
Well, actually, it was me that wanted to know, but Beth was quite anti it. And then she was like, no, actually, you should know, because... And this is the point where I think it's actually very good for couples and for the father to find out, because it allowed you then to connect. Because before, you're just still guessing. You don't know. You're just kind of on the outside guessing what's in. The moment that we knew it was a boy, you can kind of start planning or future-proofing, or you're buying into what essentially is going to happen to you. You're imagining what color you're going to paint the bedroom, or you know, what toys you're buying, or, you know, you're imagining going to football matches, or whatever daft dad things you normally think about. You connect then to the pregnancy and a little bit better, I think, the process. So then when he's finally born, it's one of those, it's a very special moment, and it's a bit different from, because Beth talks about it, is at that moment she almost didn't want to give birth, because then it means she's having to share the thing she's grown with everybody else. It was quite that whole period of growing with him.
Oh, that's lovely.
Had been something that she'd loved very much, that then when it came to it, she almost didn't want to give him up. So it felt like, you know, she was having to share him. So, but actually that moment was incredibly, yeah, it was super special as a dad. And you are, you know, you go through that super proud moment. You make sure that, you know, your wife's okay, everything's all right, it's no problem. And then you start asking all the daft questions of the midwife and the doctors and going, is he all right? Like, I mean, is there a reason? Is there a reason why he's born that big? I mean, what is it like? It's kind of like all of those sort of questions, that the reality of it. And then, you know, it's that next thing, isn't it? And all of a sudden you're responsible for another human being that you've got there's no experience of. There's booklets and there's understanding. You can read stuff of what to do, but no one actually knows, do they? No one really knows.
No.
The emotional and physical impact that a child coming into your life has. And it's forever. And it's weird. Like, you can't ever imagine life without them then.
Yeah, you can't remember what you used to do, can you? I remember thinking, what did we used to do with all that time?
Yeah.
What did we do all day? It's so weird. So how old is he now, Tom?
He'll be 5 just before Christmas.
Oh, such a good age. And what's he into at the moment? Does he show any interest in cooking?
He enjoys cooking. Yeah, he does enjoy cooking, actually. Yeah, he likes to get involved with lots of things. He's actually really quite good at his reading and his drawing and his letters and his words and things. So he's very good at that. But in terms of like playing and toys, and I mean, he was always mad over cars, mad about cars. I mean, he learnt all of his colours and he learnt counting from watching Formula One. In fact, he was watching that. he was watching that on TV before Peppa Pig, and that wasn't forced upon him by a dad that likes Formula One. That was
whatever.
Truly, was him choosing. He would sit there for 20, 25 minutes watching cars race. Like, and learning the colours. And there's a racing driver for Red Bull called Max Verstappen, and he could pronounce his name better than he could say the word yellow. I mean, that was I was quite impressed with that as a 3-year-old. So he loves his cars. He's well into dinosaurs, pretty much like any other 5-year-old, I suppose. Cars, dinosaurs, running around, kicking football, going on a scooter, loves going to a BMX track, all of those sort of things.
And is he still massive?
Yeah, he's a big lad. Yeah, he's in like 6-7-year-old clothes where he's...
Well, actually, one of my life highlights, I'll give it up now, was standing behind you once, Tom, in the queue for the Eurostar. And you're not short yourself, are you?
No, where was I going?
We were both coming back from Paris to London Do you remember me at all? No?
With a load of blokes.
Yeah, you were.
Yeah, that was other Mission Star chefs. So that would have been Fat Bane, Paul Fozzie and Daniel Clifford. There was four of us. We all went for lunch.
Yeah, you looked really smart. You had a really cool outfit on. You had a really cool grey jacket and then you had really cool trainers on, I remember.
Annie, you know, you obviously spent far too long looking.
We all went to Paris for lunch. So that was, so all those other three chefs have all got two Michelin stars themselves each in their restaurants. So restaurants at Bain's, Bibendum and Midsummer House in Cambridge. And we've all been very, very good friends for a long, long, long time. And we went for a lunch at a French restaurant, Guy Savoy, which is a three Michelin star restaurant in Paris, and we all went there for a bit of a boys' trip, and we were there lunch and back there and back on the same day.
I love it. A normal boys' trip is like strip clubs in Prague, and you go to Michelin star restaurants in Paris.
I think I'd quite like one of your boys'
trips.
I've
got to be honest, we're like four. I'm 47 now. I stopped drinking over 7 years.
You're not 47. Stop it. If someone said how old's Tom Kerridge, I would say late 20s, early 30s.
Oh, give over, woman.
I'm serious. Honestly, you've got a very boyish face, don't you think?
Well, that's because I gave up drinking it. So I stopped.
That the clip? Right, there we go. That's the key.
Wend, that's what we're doing this weekend.
No, we're not.
So the boys' trips to strip clubs, that ended a while ago. Well, I've got to be honest. It also kind of half ended when people end up kind of knowing who you are. You can't be in a strip club when people know who you are.
Yeah, good point.
You're not exactly inconspicuous, are you?
No.
Well, I'm going to step away from the slightly weird questions of my co-host and ask you something a bit more normal. So you've got two Michelin stars.
Yeah.
Where were you when you heard, and what was that like? Because it must be like the equivalent is Annie and I winning a Nobel Prize, which is obviously on the cards, but not quite yet. So how does it feel? What, like, do you jump up and down like a little kid? What do you do?
We were actually in the restaurant at the time, and someone came from, we knew it was the launch of the Michelin Guide that day, and Michelin had contacted us to say that they're filming lots of videos up and down the country to coincide with the launch of the guide. So they sent a young cameraman with the camera, and then he was filming the launch of the guide and passed me a letter.
Oh, wow.
And I opened the letter. And the letter, as I read the letter out, they filmed it all, and it was us, a letter from Rebecca Burr, who's head of mission, letting us know that we'd achieved two Michelin stars in that guide, which was amazing. The team, like, it was brilliant. It was fantastic to achieve that sort of thing. I mean, it's a huge team effort, and it's something that we were so, like, so super proud of. It was just, it was an amazing experience. It was fantastic. But it's all captured on film. So it's there on a YouTube video somewhere. I can't remember what it's called, but it is. Yeah, the launch of the Michelin Guide 2012 on YouTube is there somewhere.
I was going to say, how does it feel when your son asks you for spaghetti hoops for tea or says that he prefers school's macaroni cheese to yours when you've got a Michelin star? Does it feel really gutting?
No, to be honest, I'm actually quite proud of that. I like the fact that he's not yet a food snob. He still most definitely likes alphabetti spaghetti. He's a big fan of crappy sausages. He's like any other standard four-year-old that he eats. He doesn't eat particularly adventurous food. He'll do a bit of broccoli now and then. Loves carrots, peas and sweet corn is about the only vegetable he'll eat right now. Apart from that, he's very into beige, brown. And
they
crisp.
All are.
Exactly. You can't really do much about it, can you? You know, that's just the way that it is.
So what is then the go-to Tom Kerridge tea of choice for a fussy four-year-old?
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask, what's for tea tonight, Tom?
Tea tonight? I have absolutely no idea. It's whether I get back in time for tea tonight or not. I'm never really there in time for it. He's normally had tea apart from the weekends. So a special tea. We're quite lucky during lockdown. I still use some of our suppliers who are doing home delivery. So he's a massive fan of calamari. Absolutely loves squid.
Oh, yeah.
So we did deep fried squid with chips and peas last Friday. And he's honestly, it's like his dream tea. So So we got the squid, fresh squid, and we cut it up and we put it all in the breadcrumbs and the
bits. It's my dream tea.
Yeah,
Tom.
It's a bit of a step on from a fish finger, isn't it?
It's great. He does love fish. We're very lucky, you know, that, you know, he'll quite happily push on with fish. It's a big favourite of his. So, yeah, so squid rings with oven chips and peas is kind of like a dream go-to tea.
That sounds perfect. I'll have that, please.
So, not wanting to get too serious, but I was reading a bit about your parents, Tom, because I was trying to understand kind of what kind of dad you were and why you became the dad you were. And I read you say that you didn't feel like you grew up with a dad because he was diagnosed with MS when you were 6, I think. Then your parents got divorced and then he died when you were 18. How has that experience shaped who you've become as a dad?
Well, massively, I suppose, but I have nothing to gauge it on. Like, say, so my dad was ill when I was young, but then mum and dad split up when I was 11, but he was never, like, even there as kids, he wasn't there very much. He was always always doing his own thing, is probably the best way of describing it. Mm-hmm. And then not very well, and then became very, very ill from my early teen years onwards to the point where he passed away. So it was always, I never grew up with a father figure. So I had nothing to
base it on. Yeah.
I had nothing to gauge it against. You know, my mum did an exceptional and amazing job of being.
Yeah, she sounds like a superhero, Tom.
Yeah, no, she did an amazing job of being this brilliant all-round super parent. You only realise now, being a parent, how difficult that must be, you know.
You only realise when you become one, don't you?
Yeah, so to be honest, I've got nothing to gauge being a dad on. We're both learning that father-figure relationship as we go on together. So, I mean, he's got a granddad from Beth's side, you know. Grandpa is still Beth's father is still around, and he's an amazing individual. So he's got, you know, in terms of grandparents, that's great. But in terms of a father figure, we're both learning as we go. We're making it up as we go along. And I mean, again, that's that blaggy chaos I quite like. I've got nothing to gauge against whether I'm doing it right or wrong. So we're just going, you know, as long as we're getting there, it's all right, you know.
In a way, it must be quite freeing because you can just choose who you want to be, can't you? You're not trying to live up to an idol or like this perfect dad thing, are you?
No, I mean, I suppose I've got a vision of what I should be like as a perfect dad. And then quite often you don't reach that, you know, like sometimes when you're tired and grumpy and he's just being really naughty and he's pulling the dog by the legs and you're just like you get aces, stop that, like you lose, not lose your temper, but you just kind of go, that enough, you know. And then afterwards you think, we've all done that, Tom.
Yeah, often.
Of course, like, and it's standard behaviour, and also kids need to understand the point of discipline of when to stop, you know. And you can't, you know, it doesn't work with a 4-year-old if you go, just don't do that because the dog doesn't like its legs being pulled off. You know what I mean? It's kind of like,
no,
it doesn't. You know, you have to find that way of getting that balance across. But yeah, sometimes you go, oh, maybe I could have dealt with that differently, or I could have sat him down and we could have talked about maybe the pain that the dog's in, or, you know, the reality of it, you know, the day-to-day version of life like that, it's the same for everybody. Parental guilt, I know, is the same for everybody, you know, although mine is slightly, probably a little bit more extreme like everything else, that, you know, sometimes I'm out of the door early and not back till very late at night, and that might be 5, 6, 7 days in a row, so I might not see him some points when the restaurants are open for 6 or 7 days. But then you go, actually, so that parental guilt of not being around is quite hard, but everybody has that. Everybody has the same thing, you know. You can't pick your kids up from school because you're still working, and some of them have to go into kids club, or they have to do, everybody has some level of going, you know, I should be doing this more, or being a better parent by doing this, or be. So it's just getting to terms and trying to find the balance of it, but I don't think it's any different to anybody else.
No, I also think that when I hear people like, or anyone who's a parent, say what you've just said, which is, you sit back and wonder sometimes, am I getting it right? I think it probably shows that you are, because you're bothering to worry about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I worry more when I hear people say, yes, I'm an amazing parent and it's all going really well.
We just know they're lying. Really? Basically, they're just not telling the truth at that point. Now, Tom.
Yes.
One of the biggest net mum stories of all time.
Oh, yes, this is so true.
Is about you.
Yes.
Really?
It's a story about tinfoil. Hear me out here. So on one of your shows a few years ago, you were talking about the fact that the whole nation uses tinfoil the wrong way, because we all use it shiny side up and we should be using it shiny side down. And we ran this story and hundreds of thousands of people.
Literally hundreds of thousands.
And it's now one of our well-known reruns, and it's colloquially known as the Tom Kerridge tinfoil story, and it goes out all the time and it always does well.
I love that.
But this is where the pressure's on, because now I need you to create another kitchen tip that's going to get me.
Yeah, come on. What have we been doing wrong, Tom? What do we need to know?
What have we been doing wrong? Let me have a little think. I mean, there's one that I've seen recently about box cheese graters.
Go on.
So your cheese grater, your box grater, most people stand it up and grate downwards.
Yeah.
However, if you put it on the side.
Yeah.
And then grate that way. That's supposed to be the right way of doing it, because you get a greater volume out of it and it's easier to do.
Oh, my goodness.
Will it stop me grating my knuckles as well, which is a common occurrence?
Exactly. So we may well, all of us may well have been grating cheese incorrectly.
Story. Because also I get really bad arm ache from grating.
Annie, come on.
Seriously.
How much cheese are you grating?
And also, I could never be a chef. This is really boring. Spat me. I can't lift up a lot of saucepans when they've got stuff in them because my wrists just bend back. But anyway, that's a whole other.
This is why she's a journalist, not a chef. Just
I think that might be more trips to the gym needed.
I know. Well, talking of that, this is on my list of questions. Tell us how you transformed yourself body-wise, because it's incredible.
Well, I stopped drinking, which was a big thing, and then you know, as I was approaching 40, I recognised that I need to do something. It's an age thing that you go.
Yeah, it is an age.
I need to make a decision about not being that person. You know, I recognise that I had an issue. I have an issue with alcohol. I have an issue with excessive behaviour. I go, okay, I really need to get a grip of my life here. I need to make a change. And it wasn't professional reasons. You know, the businesses were doing very well. I've done 2 or 3 books by this point. Television was great. You know, it was just like, right, okay. It was very self-recognized point of going, right, I need to make that change. So I swam. I used to swim quite a bit. So I swam every day. I used to swim a mile every day and was very conscious about what I ate. And then I still am, and then it still goes backwards. I go for extremes. I went through swimming, and then I went massively into weightlifting, and I tried to lift really heavy stuff, and I got quite big. And then I stopped again, and then I've lost a load of weight. And now I've started weightlifting again. And then once I've done that, I'll probably then go into trying to be swimming again and then slim down. And I get
So it's about mixing it up so that you're always interested in what you're doing, right?
100%. Yeah, it's interested and focused and have goals that I kind of want to achieve of going. And none of that is to do with actually physical appearance. It's all to do with
how you feel.
Yeah, and being out there on a daily basis to go, right, I want to get to this point.
Yeah.
I get quite obsessed with numbers in terms of, right, I need to achieve this, or I want to lift this particular weight, or I want to ride this far on a watt bike, or I want to do whatever. Like all of those sort of things, I get kind of like a slightly OCD kind of dog that gets obsessed with a tennis ball that I need to try and focus on that thing.
But wait, what time of day are you doing all this? You've got a million businesses and employees. You've got a son.
Yeah.
When do you do this?
So pre-lockdown, I used to try and get into the gym around about 6 o'clock in the morning. So
I would
get up and go into the gym at 6 and then do an hour or two there and then go on to the rest of the day. Or I try and squeeze it in during the day, or I'm now in lockdown. I've got one of those watt bikes at home, and just finished with a full squat rack in the garage yesterday being built. So I'm still on the weight stuff. But the good thing about having it at home is now that if I still have to leave at 6 in the morning, go anywhere, and I've missed the gym, it means I can still do it at midnight when I get back. So I will still be obsessively I'd rather give up on sleep than give up on living.
Wow.
That's a good line.
It's a really good line. I think I need to become more like you.
You've talked quite a lot about giving up booze. Was there a moment where you went, okay, enough now, I'm just a twat when I'm drunk and I need to stop?
But also, was it easy? You say you gave it up, like you just woke up and like, yeah, I'm going to stop that. But it must have been hard.
Yeah, so, I mean, there was a build-up towards the point of giving up. I knew the date. It was like the 6th of January 2013, and I was like, right, okay. So that point was it was because there was the run up to that year had been massive. Like there, I was drinking hugely, excessively, massively every single day, every and then that Christmas, that November, December, the run up to it, there were a number of like really massive idiot incidents that, I mean, a couple made newspaper stuff and a couple made, and I was just like, oh, and then there were a couple of like really stupid things that happened that I couldn't say, but they were just so daft, and they were with people that were high profile, and they were just, and I was just like, my God, this is just getting crazily out of hand now, this run up to the point. But I knew the point I was giving up drinking, and that I think probably made it even more excessive, because I thought, well, I needed to get through New Year that year, New Year's Eve, and then there was a big party that I knew was planned on, I think it was the 9th or the 6th of January then, and then I woke up, I knew that next morning I wasn't going to drink, so I woke up the next morning and I stopped. And yes, it's incredibly difficult, it still is very difficult, but it's nowhere near as difficult as it used to be. Like it was very, very, very hard, because it's suddenly, it's not just taking some, it's not just like, right, I'm not eating biscuits again. It's a change of your whole life, your social, your connection, your just everything that you do. Alcohol is involved in so many different parts of people's lives, you know. And I built myself up over a 6-month period to go, and that's the point where I'm going to stop.
That's still pretty impressive, though, just to stop and decide by sheer force of will.
Yeah, well done, you, Tom. That's not easy.
But yeah, thanks. I mean, there were a couple of incidents right that year. In that first year, there were probably about 3 times that I fell off the wagon, and then that was it. Yeah, there was a period in November when it was all went a little crazy. There was my 40th birthday, which
That's
I
hard.
Knew where I was yeah. going to drink. I knew I was going to drink, and I thought I'd have a drink on the day, but that, like standard, turned into a 5-day bender. And then there was a period in November when it all went horribly wrong. And then after that, that was it. There was nothing. There's been nothing. Nothing since November 2013.
Well, good on you.
Good man. I'm really impressed. Yeah. Now, switching to lighter topics, where do you most want to eat when lockdown lifts? And should we copy you?
There's so many different brilliant restaurants up and down the country, aren't there? I mean, and it depends the sort of thing that you want. It depends if you want to go super posh or super special, or whether you just want to go something really nice and easy. But for me, there's a brilliant little restaurant in Tankerton near Whitstable called Jojo's. Nikki is the chef there. She cooks brilliant, brilliant food, and very, very simple, kind of tapas-y, sharing-y style dishes. Little man loves it there. They do these kind of like great little deep-fried, cheesy, gnocchi ball things as a starter, and he loves them. And the idea of that kind of like family style sharing in an atmosphere that's just fun, that's no, you know, so that we can all go. I mean, we can all have special occasions with other halves, which amazing, but actually taking the whole family there. So Jojo's in Tankerton near Whitstable, that's where I'd go.
Right, I'm going as soon as we're allowed.
Yeah. Okay, so we're starting to round up, and we always ask this of our guests. Tom Kerridge, how do you want to be remembered?
Do I want to be remembered? I'm like,
oh, okay, maybe you don't. Yeah, that's interesting.
It's a bit self-indulgent and a bit vain, in it, to want to be remembered. I think probably just by close friends and family as being somebody that just had a go. That's probably the best thing. Like someone who had a go at living a life, that would probably be the best thing.
I like that.
I like that too. Now, lowering the tone, as I am wont to do, I am a fellow Wiltshire hillbilly, Tom.
Yeah.
So I have to ask you, my favourite Wiltshire phrase of all time is Gert Lush. What's yours?
I would go with that, actually. I mean, I don't normally use the word Gert, and to be honest, Lush I use a lot. But I was born in Wiltshire, but I've never actually lived there. So it was the only hospital that could fit my mum in on the day. So I was born in Wiltshire, then for the first year I lived in Bristol, and then I moved to Gloucester when I was just before I was one. So I count myself as coming from Gloucester, because where I was born, I never lived. So it's quite a weird nomadic first year. So I've got no place that I really go, oh, yeah, that's home. Like the most home I've ever felt is Marlow, I think.
But you sound quite Bristolian. There's a lot of Bristolian in that accent.
How dare you? It's Gloucester, not Bristol. It's about, Gloucester's about 30 miles up the M5, and it's a far superior city to Bristol. Far superior. It's got a much nicer rugby pitch, and it's got, what else has Gloucester got going for it?
Let's not go rugby, because I'm from near Bath, so we'll have a row.
Yeah, well, see, that's it. I mean, there couldn't be anywhere worse, could there? That little man, we're fairly certain, is going to grow up being a rugby player. Whether he's going to be a pro or not, we don't know, but he loves the aggression.
He's definitely going to be a prop, that's for sure.
The point when he says, Bath want to sign me, that's the point where he has to leave home.
Right, you've got to ask him the last question, Annie. I can't talk to him anymore.
Okay, all right, I'll split up the fight. So our last question, we ask it of everyone, every guest, every episode is, please can you imagine you're tucking Wendy and I into bed and sing us your lullaby? Because every family has a little song that they sing if their kids can't sleep. We want to know what yours is and we want to hear it, please.
Yeah, I'm going to play you it, right? So this is the lullaby that little man wants, right? Every night that he goes to bed, he has to have this on. It's on Spotify, and he loves it. And it's soothing strings, right, for sleeping babies.
Oh.
It's got Schlaf, Kinderlein, Schlaf, and he loves it. And that is it. And he will go to sleep to this. Right, as of right now, he'll go to sleep with it. Either that or the Ninja Kids song.
I think you're going to have a rush of people now going to download the German baby strings, whatever it's called.
Perfect.
Thank you, Tom.
Right, thank you so much, Mr. Kerridge. We admire you greatly, and you've been a fab guest.
No worries. No, thanks very much for having us on.
Good luck with everything.
Lovely to chat to you. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.